front row of Union soldiers falls in bloody chaos. The second line turns and runs down the hill. This is Grant's vaunted army, a force better rested, better fed, and better equipped than the half-dressed Confederates. And yet the bluecoats flee in terror, their white handkerchiefs littering the ground. It is a triumph, and in that instant the Confederate force is overcome by righteous indignation. The memory of that hard overnight march in the rain, the starvation, the delirious craziness born of exhaustion, all of it blends into a single moment of fury. The rebels leap to their feet and chase after the bluecoats. Down the hill they run, caps flying off, curses streaming from their mouths. Dead men are everywhere, on both sides. The Confederates have to hop and jump over bodies, but the rebels never stop running. The Union soldiers finally gather themselves. They stop, turn, and fire. Knowing they are outgunned, the Confederates retreat back to their positions, only to be surrounded as the Union force quickly counterattacks the hill. And this time, the bluecoats aren't plotting. Union soldiers sprint up the hill, overrunning the Confederate positions. Out of ammunition and heavily outnumbered, the Army of Northern Virginia still refuses to surrender. The fighting becomes hand-to-hand. Soldiers claw at each other, swinging fists, kicking. The battle degenerated into a butchery and confused melee of personal conflicts. I saw numbers of men kill each other with bayonets and the butts of their muskets, and even bite each other's throats and ears and noses, rolling on the ground like wild beasts, one Confederate officer will write. I had cautioned my men against wearing Yankee overcoats, especially in battle, but had not been able to enforce the order perfectly. And almost at my side, I saw a young fellow of one of my companies jam the muzzle of his musket against the back of the head of his most intimate friend, clad in a Yankee overcoat, and blow his brains out. Although the battle is little remembered in history, witnesses will swear they have never seen more suffering or a fight as desperate as during the final moments of Sailor's Creek. And yet, it still grows more vicious. None other than General George Armstrong Custer, who has been killing Confederates since breakfast, has broken off from his former position and races his cavalry through the pine thickets behind the rebel lines. His horsemen ride into the action behind him, sabers swinging. Custer is impervious to personal injury, his savagery today adding to his growing legend for fearlessness. Custer slashes his sword, showing no mercy. He spurs his men to do the same. Rebel troops on foot are cut to pieces by bullets and steel blades. The Union artillerymen, not wanting to be left out, pull their guns to the edge of Sailor's Creek and take aim into those stray bands of Confederate soldiers on the fringes of the fighting. Firing rounds of canister and grape, lethal small balls and bits of sharpened metal designed to maim and disfigure, the artillery adds to the chaos. On the ground, bodies missing heads, legs, and arms are sprawled in absurd contortions, a gruesome reminder of what close-quarter combat will yield. Soon, one by one, the rebels raise their musket butts in the air as a signal of surrender. Union soldiers round up these men whom they have fought so savagely for the previous hour. Then, shocked by the sunken eyes and gaunt Confederate faces, some of the bluecoats open their rucksacks and share their food. The last rebels to surrender are the sailors and Marines recently converted to infantry. Surrounded in a grove of trees with no hope of escape, they lay down their rifles. One Confederate corps has managed to escape from the confusion of Sailor's Creek, and now it reaches General Lee at the top of the ridge. Seeing his forces trudging back toward him, Lee grabs a battle flag and holds it aloft. The Confederate stars and bars snaps in the wind, the flag's bright red color a compass beacon guiding the weary surviving soldiers to safety. Union forces try to give chase but abandon the effort when the darkness makes it impossible to tell whether they are shooting at friend or foe. A day that started so well for the Confederates at Rice's Station, then saw triumph at Highbridge, is now finished. In the morning, Lee will continue his escape, but without 13 battle flags, 300 wagons, 70 ambulances, and almost 8,000 men either killed or taken prisoner. 10 of Lee's top officers are either dead or captured. Among the captured is his eldest son, Custis Lee. The Union Army, on the other hand, suffers 1,200 casualties. So fierce is the fighting, and so courageous the action of the fighters, that 56 Union soldiers will receive the Congressional Medal of Honor for their actions on the field that day. Night falls, and so ends what will become known as the Black Thursday of the Confederacy. Half of Lee's army is gone. Except for General Longstreet, his remaining generals think the situation is hopeless. Lee continues to improvise, still looking for a way to save his army and get to the Carolinas. Yet even he is devastated. A few more Sailor's Creeks, and it will be all over, sighs Morse Robert. But Lee cannot bring himself to utter the one word he dreads most, surrender. Chapter 14, Friday, April 7th, 1865, City Point, Virginia, dawn. Lincoln is desperate for news from the front. The time away from Washington was meant to be a working vacation, and it has clearly revived the president. The incredible sadness he carried for so long is gone, replaced by serene joy. Mary Lincoln has joined her husband at City Point, bringing with her a small complement of guests from Washington. The mood in the nation's capital has turned festive since the fall of Richmond. Mary and her guests plan to visit Richmond in the morning, as if the burned-out husk of a city has become a tourist attraction. Lincoln will stay behind on the riverboat and tend to the war. Still, he is glad for the company. He tells jokes and makes small talk, all the while wondering when the next telegram from General Grant will arrive. Early on the morning of April 7th, just hours after Sailor's Creek, Lincoln receives the news for which he's been waiting. Grant's telegram states that Sheridan has ridden over the battlefield, counting Confederate dead and captured, particularly the many top Confederate generals now in Union custody. "If the thing is pressed," Grant quotes Sheridan as saying, "I think Lee will surrender." Lincoln telegraphs his heartfelt reply, "Let the thing be pressed." Chapter 15, Palm Sunday, April 9th, 1865, Appomattox Courthouse. The end has come. General Robert E. Lee rides forth from the Confederate lines into no man's land, separating his dwindling force from the vast Union forces. The Army of Northern Virginia is cornered in a sedate little village called Appomattox Courthouse. Lee's 8,000 men surrounded on three sides by Grant's 60,000. After escaping Sailor's Creek, the rebels reach Farmville, only to be attacked again and forced to flee before they could finish eating their rations. They raced across High Bridge, only to find that mortar wouldn't burn. The Union Army crossed right behind them. Grant was then able to get ahead and block Lee's path to the Carolinas. Lee's final great hope for a breakout came the previous night. He had entrusted his toughest general, John Gordon from Georgia, with punching a hole in the Union lines. The attack began at 5 p.m. 3 hours later, after Gordon encountered wave after never-ending wave of blue-clad soldiers, too many for his men to beat down, he sent word back to Lee that he had fought my corps to a frazzle. In other words, Gordon could not break through. Lee's proud shoulders slumped as he received the news. "There is nothing left for me to do but go to see General Grant," he said aloud. Lee was surrounded by his staff but was talking to himself. The man who had succeeded his entire life, excelling at everything and failing at nothing, was beaten. "I would rather die 1,000 deaths," he said. Dressed in an impeccable formal gray uniform, polished black boots, and clean red sash, Lee now rides forth. A spectacular ceremonial sword is buckled around his waist. He expects to meet Grant once he crosses over into the Union lines, there to surrender his sword and be taken prisoner. But before Grant's soldiers march him off to the penitentiary, Lee plans to argue on behalf of his men, seeking the best possible terms of surrender for the Army of Northern Virginia. He has written to Grant repeatedly on the subject. Grant's evasive replies have given little evidence as to which way he leans on the issue. Lee and a small group of aides ride to a spot between the Union and Confederate lines. They halt their horses in the middle of the country lane and wait for Grant to meet them. And they wait. And they wait some more. All the while, it becomes more obvious that the Union forces are not just enjoying a quiet Sunday morning, cleaning rifles, filing cartridge cases, putting out the breakfast fires. No, they are preparing for battle. Lee can see it in the way the gun crews have unlimbered the cannons and howitzers and are now sighting them toward his lines. The big guns, those M1857 Napoleons, can drop a 12-pound projectile on top of a man's head from a mile away, and those howitzers can lob an 18-pound shell nearly as far. Looking at the Union lines, Lee sees dozens of these guns capable of inflicting catastrophic damage. If this is a display of force by Grant to hasten Lee's surrender, it is working. But Grant does not show himself. In fact, he is miles away, suffering from a severe migraine headache. Lee sits astride Traveler, painfully vulnerable to a sniper's bullet despite his flag of truce. After about 2 hours with no response, Lee sees a Union soldier riding out. The soldier informs Lee that the attack will be launched in a few moments. For his own safety, Lee must return to the Confederate lines. The boom of artillery breaks the morning quiet. Lee jots a quick note intended for Grant and hands it to an orderly who gallops toward the Union lines under a white flag. He also requests that the attack be postponed until Grant can be located. With the irrefutable logic of a man conditioned to follow orders, the Union colonel in charge tells Lee's courier that he does not have the authority to halt the attack. It will go forward as planned. As the courier gallops back to Lee, Union skirmishers march to the front and prepare to probe Confederate lines for vulnerability. Lee writes another letter to Grant asking for a suspension of hostilities pending the adjustment of the terms of surrender of this army. Even as fighting threatens to break out all around him, Lee is unruffled. He sits astride Traveler, whose flanks are flecked with mud, waiting for permission to surrender. But when the first wave of skirmishers is just 100 yards away, Lee has no choice but to find safety. With a reluctant tug on Traveler's reins, he turns back toward his men. Moments later, he is stopped. A Union courier tells Lee that his letter has not found Grant, but it has found General George Meade, whom Lee knew long before the war. Meade has ordered a 60-minute truce, hoping that Grant can be located in the meantime. Lee turns Traveler once again. He rides back toward the front and dismounts. It's been 4 hours since he first sought the surrender meeting. The sun is now directly overhead. Lee sits on a pile of fence rails in the meager shade of an apple tree, bearing the first buds of spring. There he writes yet another letter to Grant, hoping to impress upon the Union general the seriousness of his intentions. This, too, is sent off under a white flag through the Union lines. Finally, at 12:15, a lone Union officer and his Confederate escort arrive to see Lee. The officer, a colonel named Babcock, delivers a letter into Lee's hands. Quote, General R. E. Lee, commanding C.S. Armies. Your note of this date is a but this moment, 11:50 a.m., received. In consequence of my having passed from the Richmond and Lynchburg Road to the Farmville and Richmond Road, I am at this writing about 4 miles west of Walker's Church and will push forward to the front for the purpose of meeting you. Notice sent on this road where you wish the interview to take place will meet me. Very respectfully, your obedient servant, Lieutenant General U.S. Grant. With a mixture of sadness and relief, Lee and his three aides ride past the Union lines. These troops do not cheer him, as the Army of Northern Virginia is in the habit of doing. Instead, the Sunday afternoon is preternaturally quiet after so many days and years of war. There's no thunder of artillery or jingle of a cavalry limber. Just those miles-long lines of men in blue, staring up at Lee as he rides past, dressed so impeccably and riding so tall and straight-backed in the saddle. Not even his eyes give away his mourning, nor the dilemma that he has endured since Sailor's Creek, when it became clear that his army was no longer able to acquit itself. Per Grant's letter, Lee sends his aide, Colonel Charles Marshall, up the road to find a meeting place. Marshall settles on a simple home. By a great twist of fate, the house belongs to a grocer named Wilmer McLean, who moved to Appomattox Courthouse to escape the war. A cannonball had landed in his fireplace during the first Battle of Bull Run at the very start of the conflict. Fleeing to a quieter corner of Virginia was his way of protecting his family from harm. But the Civil War once again finds Wilmer McLean. He and his family are asked to leave the house. Soon Lee marches up the front steps and takes a seat in the parlor. Again, he waits. At 1:30, after a half hour, Lee hears a large group of horsemen galloping up to the house. Moments later, General U.S. Grant walks into the parlor. He wears a private's uniform. It is missing a button. He has affixed shoulder boards bearing the three stars of a lieutenant general, but otherwise there is nothing elegant about the Union leader. He has been wearing the same clothes since Wednesday night, and they are now further splattered by mud from his 35-mile ride this morning. Grant, Colonel Amos Webster, a member of the Union's general staff, will later remember, covered with mud in an old faded uniform, looked like a fly on a shoulder of beef. Removing his yellow cloth riding gloves, Grant steps forward and shakes Lee's hand. Almost 20 years earlier, during the Mexican War, he was a mere lieutenant when Lee was a major soon to be promoted to colonel. Grant well recalled how Lee had scolded him because of his slovenly appearance. While not a vindictive man, U.S. Grant does not suffer slights easily. He has an encyclopedic memory. Lee has only a minor recollection of meeting Grant prior to this moment in Wilmer McLean's parlor. But Grant remembers every single word. So while Lee sits before him, proud but fallen, resplendent in his spotless uniform, Grant looks and smells like a soldier who could not care less about appearance or ceremony. As the moment of surrender nears, however, Grant starts to feel a bit embarrassed by the prospect of asking one of history's great generals to give up his army and has second thoughts about his dress. General Lee was dressed in full uniform, which was entirely new, he will later write in his memoirs, and was wearing a sword of considerable value, very likely the sword that had been presented by the state of Virginia. At all events, it was an entirely different sword than the one that would ordinarily be worn in the field. In my rough traveling suit, the uniform of a private with the straps of a lieutenant general, I must have contrasted very strangely with a man so handsomely dressed, 6 feet high and of faultless form. But this was not a matter that I thought of until afterwards. As Grant's generals and staff, among them Custer and Sheridan, file into the room and stand to one side, Lee's aides gather behind their leader. Grant and Lee sit at a small wooden table. An area rug covers the floor beneath them. The room's balance of power is tilted heavily toward the Union. Grant and his 12 to Lee and his 2. Lee's men are staff officers, neatly dressed and strangers to the battlefield. Grant's men, on the other hand, include staff and top generals, men who have spent the last week on horseback harassing Lee's army. They are dressed for battle, swords clanking and spurs jangling, the heels of their cavalry boots echoing on the wooden floor. They can barely suppress smirks, betraying their good fortune, but not only destroying Lee's army, but to be present at the moment of Morris Roberts' greatest humiliation. Sheridan in particular has great reason to be here. He believes that Lee's request for a ceasefire in these negotiations are yet another clever attempt to help his army escape. A shipment of rations is waiting for Lee and his army at the local railway depot, and Sheridan is convinced that Lee means to use the food to get him one step closer to the Carolinas. What Sheridan and General Custer know, but Lee does not, is that Union cavalry has already captured that station. The food is in Union hands. Even if Lee is lying and somehow manages to escape, his army will never make it the final 100 miles to freedom on empty stomachs. "I met you once before, General Lee," Grant starts. His voice is calm, as if this moment is just a random occasion for small talk. "We were serving in Mexico when you came over from General Scott's headquarters to visit Garland's brigade, to which I belong. I have always remembered your appearance, and I think I should have recognized you anywhere." "Yes, I know I met you on that occasion," Lee answers in the same casual tone as Grant, letting the reference sit between them, though certainly not apologizing. His face, in Grant's estimation, is impassible. "I have often thought of it and tried to recollect how you look, but I never been able to recall a single feature," Lee says. The generals speak of Mexico, recalling long-ago names. Grant finds the conversation so pleasant that he momentarily forgets the reason for their meeting. Lee is the one to take the initiative. "I suppose, General Grant, that the object of your present meeting is fully understood," he says. "I asked to see you to ascertain upon what terms you would receive the surrender of my army." Grant calls for his order book, a thin volume of yellow paper with carbon sheets. He lights a cigar and stares at a page, composing the sequence of words that will most amicably end the war. A cloud of smoke hovers around his head. Lee does not smoke, and he watches as Grant, after waving a distracted hand in the air to shoo the cigar smoke away, write out his terms in pen. When he has finished, Grant hands the book over to Lee. Morris Robert digests the words in silence. The terms are remarkable in their lenience. Lee will not even have to surrender his sword. The gist is simple. Put down your guns and go home. Let's rebuild the nation together. This was President Lincoln's vision, to which Grant subscribed. As if to underscore this point, members of Grant's staff tentatively asked Robert E. Lee for permission to go behind Confederate lines. They have old friends over there, friends they have seen only through the lens of a spyglass across some great width of battlefield these last 4 years. Lee grants permission. There is little else to say. Lee is humiliated, but also grateful that his enemies have granted such favorable terms. He will be able to return to his army with some good news. Grant and Lee rise simultaneously and shake hands. The two warriors will never meet again. As Lee rides back to his lines, the Army of Northern Virginia spontaneously gathers on both sides of the road. Lee fights back the tears as men call out to him. His dissolved army will soon turn over their guns and battle flags. This is their last chance to show their great love and respect for their leader. Men, he calls out to them, we have fought this war together and I have done the best I can for you. Each group cheers as Lee rides past, only to give in to their sorrow and break down in sobs, all along the route to his quarters. Meantime, the reconciliation is beginning. Confederate and Union officers are renewing old friendships. They went over, had a pleasant time with their old friends, and brought some of them back with them when they returned. Grant will write 20 years later, recalling that the McLean household became their de facto meeting place that night. The men swap stories of their lives and remembrances of battles won and lost. Here, the officers of both armies came in great numbers and seemed to enjoy the meeting as much as though they had been friends separated for a long time while fighting under the same flag. For the time being, it looked very much as if all thought of the war had escaped their minds. But the war is not so easily forgotten by others. Unbeknownst to all those men who risked their lives to fight those great battles, men who deservedly savor the peace, plans are being hatched throughout the South to seek revenge for the Union victory. Part 2. The Ides of Death. Chapter 16. Monday, April 10th, 1865, Washington, D.C., evening. It seems like the entire town is drunk. Lee's Confederate Army has surrendered. In the Union capital, whiskey is chugged straight out of the bottle. Church bells toll. Pistols are fired into the air. Fireworks explode. Newsboys hawk final editions chock full of details from Appomattox. Brass bands play. Church hymns are sung. 35 U.S. flags are hoisted, and Army howitzers launch an astonishing 500-gun salute, which shatters windows from miles around the city. The war is done. After 4 long years and more than 600,000 dead altogether, euphoria now floats through the air like an opiate. Complete strangers clasp one another's hands like long-lost friends. They rub shoulders in taverns, restaurants, cat houses, and the impromptu glow of blazing street-side bonfires. Revelers march from one place to the next, passing the flask, aimless and amazed. Sooner or later, it becomes obvious that their passion needs a purpose, or at the very least, a focus. The human mass snakes toward the White House, handheld torches lighting the way. The people of Washington, D.C., overcome by the news of the war's end, hope to glimpse their president on this historic night. Perhaps, if they are lucky, he will give one of the speeches for which he has become so famous. The nation's capital is not yet the cosmopolitan city it will become. The streets are mostly dirt and mud. It is not uncommon for traffic to stop as farmers drive cattle to market. Open spaces have been military staging areas during the war, with the camp followers and soldiers' businesses that such a designation implies. The Tiber Creek and its adjacent canal are open sewers, a breeding ground for typhus, cholera, and dysentery. The vile stench is made worse by the Central Market's butchers, fond of heaving freshly cleaved carcasses into the rancid waters each morning. This might not be a problem were it not for the Tiber being located a stone's throw from the Capitol building, that beautiful, unfinished idea that towers above the city like an allegory for the nation itself. To Abraham Lincoln, the Capitol is the most important structure in Washington. During the war, even when resources were limited and manpower was desperately needed on the battlefields, he refused to halt construction. Its signature element, the dome, was fitted into place just over a year ago. Inside, scaffolding still climbs up the curved walls of the unfinished rotunda. Workmen mingle with the Union soldiers who have used the Capitol as a barracks, sleeping on the sandstone floors and waking each morning to the aroma of baking bread, thanks to the cadre of bakers in the basement turning out 60,000 loaves each day for shipment to distant battlefields. The Capitol was an obvious artillery target during the war, so the gas lamps atop the dome remained unlit for the duration. Now they blaze. The Capitol glows above the frenzied crowds like some great torch of freedom, a wondrous reminder that Lincoln's common refrain of "the Union must go on" has indeed come to pass. So it is fitting that on the night the Capitol dome is lit, the crowd of more than 2,000 staggers to an unruly halt on the grass outside the White House's front door, waiting for Abraham Lincoln to show himself from the windows of the second-floor residence. When Lincoln doesn't appear right away, they cry out for him. At first, it's a few random shouts, then a consensus. Soon they roar as one. "Lincoln," the people cry. "Speech." The crowd is crazy to touch President Lincoln, to see him, to hear his voice. They continue calling out to him, the chant getting louder until the sound is deafening. But Lincoln is in no mood to speak. The president sends a messenger out to the people letting them know he is not up to it tonight. That only makes the crowd cheer louder. Lincoln tries to mollify them by going to a window, pulling back a curtain, and waving. Upon seeing the president, the crowd explodes. Men hoist their caps and umbrellas, and women wave their handkerchiefs. Still, Lincoln does not give a speech. But the crowd will not leave, so Lincoln goes to the window a second time, hoping his appearance will send them on their way. To his utter amazement, 12-year-old Tad Lincoln is now down on the grass with all of those people running through the crowd with a captured rebel battle flag. The people laugh good-naturedly at the stunned look on President Lincoln's face, then cheer him as he steps alone from the front door of the White House to retrieve his young boy. It will be impossible for him to escape without saying a word or two. Lincoln has no protection as he wades into the crowd to get Tad. The president returns inside the White House even as the folks remain in the front yard. Lincoln, at heart, is a showman. He reappears at the second floor window, smiling and holding up a hand in acknowledgement. "I am very greatly rejoiced to find that an occasion has occurred, so pleasurable that the people cannot restrain themselves," he jokes, knowing that the crowd will respond by cheering even louder. And they do. The president is tired, having hardly been able to sleep due to a series of dreadful nightmares and anxiety over the struggles still to come. He sees the bonfires and the lanterns and basks in the ovation, feeling his fatigue slip away. He hears the hurrahs, along with again the single loud cry in unison of "speech." Lincoln sighs inwardly. He has waited so long for this moment, and yet he must hold back. These words cannot be delivered impulsively, nor can he hope to be bathed in applause after they are spoken. The people need to hear the truth, even though that's not what they want to hear. The crowd wants retribution, not reconciliation. They want grand and eloquent words, inspirational words, fortifying words, even boastful words. They will tell their children's children about the night after the war was won, the night they heard the great Abraham Lincoln frame the victory in the most beautiful and poetic way possible. They wish, in other words, to witness history. Lincoln would like to indulge them, but the sentiments are half-formed and the words not yet written. Instead of telling the crowd what's on his mind, how the thrill about the war's end that filled his heart just yesterday is being replaced by a weariness at the prospect of the hard work to come, Lincoln smiles that easy grin for which he is so well known. "If you want to hear a speech," Lincoln yells to the crowd, "please come back tomorrow night." There is no malice in his tone, no undercurrent of sarcasm, born of many years of public ridicule. The veteran politician works his audience with professional ease. His unamplified voice carries powerfully through the chill night air. Spying the Navy Yard brass band taking shelter under the White House eaves, he calls out a request. "I always thought that Dixie was one of the best tunes I have ever heard. Our adversaries over the way, I know, have attempted to appropriate it. But I insist that yesterday we fairly captured it. It is now our property, he informs the crowd, then directs the band to favor us with a performance. As the musicians strike up the Confederate anthem, the crowd sings and claps to that old familiar rhythm. Lincoln then slips back into the White House and starts writing the last speech he will ever give. Chapter 17, Monday, April 10th, 1865, Washington, D.C., evening. John Wilkes Booth picks up his gun. 1 mile down Pennsylvania Avenue, so close he can almost hear the beloved strains of Dixie being belted out so heretically by a Yankee band, the 26-year-old actor stands alone in a pistol range. The smell of gunpowder mixes with the fragrant pomade of his mustache. His feet are set slightly wider than shoulder width. His lean athletic torso is turned at a right angle to the bullseye, and his right arm is extended in a line perfectly parallel with the floor. In his fist, he cradles the sort of pint-sized pistol favored by ladies and card sharps. He fires. Booth scrutinizes the target. Satisfied, he reloads his single-shot .44 caliber Derringer. His mood is a mixture of rage and despondence. Things have gone to hell since Lee surrendered. Richmond is gone, and with it the Confederate leadership. The secesh community, those Southern secessionist sympathizers living a secret life in the nation's capital, is in disarray. There's no one to offer guidance to Booth and the other secret agents of the Confederacy. At this point, there are at least 4 Confederate groups conspiring to harm President Lincoln. 2 are plotting a kidnapping. 1 is planning to smuggle dress shirts infected with yellow fever into its drawers, and another intends to blow up the White House. Booth is part of a kidnapping conspiracy. He prefers the term capture. Kidnapping is a crime, but capturing an enemy during a time of war is morally correct. The Confederate government has strict rules governing its agents' behavior. If Booth does indeed get the chance, he is allowed to capture the president, truss him like a pig, subject him to a torrent of verbal and mental harassment, and even punch him in the mouth should the opportunity present itself. The one thing he is not allowed to do is engage in black flag warfare, or in a word, murder. Booth wonders if the restriction against black flag warfare still applies, and if not, what he should do about it. That's why he's at the range. He has a major decision to make. Shooting helps him think. Booth fires again. The split-second bang fills him with power, drowning out the celebrations and focusing his mind. Again, he tamps in a ball and a percussion cap. There is a darkness to Booth's personality born of the entitlement that comes with celebrity. He is a boaster and a liar, fond of embellishing stories to make himself sound daring and adventurous. He is cruel and mercurial. He is a bully, eager to punish those who don't agree with his points of view. Outside of his love for his mother, Booth is capable of doing anything to satisfy his own urges. Booth is also a white supremacist. His most closely guarded secret is that he has temporarily given up the profession of acting to fight for the pro-slavery movement. The abolition movement, in Booth's mind, is the real cause of the Civil War, a serpent that must be crushed. Enslavement of blacks is part of the natural order, Booth believes, and central to the South's economy. Blacks, he maintains, are third-class citizens who should spend their lives working for the white man. Not only does this life fulfill them, but they are begging for correction when they step out of line. I have been through the whole South and have marked the happiness of master and man, Booth writes. I have seen the black man whipped, but only when he deserved much more than he received. As a teenager, Booth was traumatized when runaway slaves killed a schoolmate's father. He is willing to swear an oath that this sort of violence will happen on a much larger scale if the South loses the war. Newly freed slaves will slaughter Southern white men, rape their women and daughters, and instigate a bloodbath unlike any other in recorded history. The only way to prevent that is to reinstate slavery by winning the Civil War. It crushes Booth to think that the South has lost. He shuts the idea out of his mind. Lee's surrender, Booth believes, was a gross error in judgment. Even the great Marge Robert is allowed an occasional lapse. Booth takes solace in the 146,000 Confederate troops spread out from North Carolina to Texas that have refused to lay down their weapons. So long as those men are willing to fight, the Confederacy and slavery will live on. And now Booth, will give them another reason to fight. That he was born just south of the Mason-Dixon line and nearly a northerner means nothing. Booth nurtures a deep hatred for his father and the nation's father figure, Abraham Lincoln. Booth was jealous of his father, an accomplished actor who never acknowledged his young son's talent. Booth's paternal loathing has now been transferred to the president. It flared to full burn when Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Booth could have enlisted in the war, but soldiering, even for the Confederate cause, is far too mundane for his flamboyant personality. He cares little about battles won or lost or battlefields hundreds of miles from the fancy hotels he calls home. Booth is fighting the Civil War on his terms, using his talents, choreographing the action like a great director. The grand finale will be a moment straight from the stage, some stunning dramatic conclusion, when antagonist and protagonist meet face to face, settling their differences once and for all. The antagonist, of course, will win. And that antagonist will be Booth. And what could be more dramatic than kidnapping Abraham Lincoln? The plan is for Booth to gag and bind him, then smuggle him out of Washington, D.C. into the hands of Confederate forces. The President of the United States will rot in a rat-infested dungeon until slavery has been reinstated. Booth will sit before him and deliver a furious monologue, accusing Lincoln of stupidity and self-importance. It doesn't matter that Lincoln won't be able to talk back. Booth has no interest in anything the President has to say. Lincoln keeps a summer residence 3 miles outside of Washington at a place called the Soldier's Home, seeking respite from the Washington humidity or just to get away from the office seekers and politicos permeating the White House year-round. The president escapes there alone on horseback most evenings. From George Washington onward, presidents of the United States have usually been comfortable traveling with an entourage. But Lincoln, who enjoys his solitude, has no patience for that. The president thinks his getaways are secret, but men like Booth and members of the Confederate Secret Service are always watching. Booth's original mission, as defined by his Southern handlers, was to capture Lincoln while he rode on the lonely road to the soldier's home. Booth tried and failed twice. Now he has a new plan, one that preys on Lincoln's fondness for the theater. He will grab him in mid-performance from the presidential box at a Washington playhouse. The scheme, however, is so crazy, so downright impossible, that none of his co-conspirators will go along with it. One of them has even backed out completely and taken the train home. It is as if Booth has rehearsed and rehearsed for a major performance, only to have the production canceled moments before the curtain rises. He has poured thousands of dollars into the plan. Some of that money has come from his own pocket, but most has been supplied by the Confederacy. And now the scheme will never come to pass. Booth fires at the bullseye. The Derringer is less than 6 inches long, made of brass with a 2-inch barrel. It launches a single large-caliber ball instead of a bullet and is accurate only at close range. For this reason, it is often called a gentleman's pistol, small and easily concealed in a pocket or boot. The Derringer is ideal for ending an argument or extracting oneself from a dangerous predicament, but wholly unsuited for the battlefield. Booth has purchased other weapons for his various plots, including the cache of revolvers and long-bladed daggers now hidden in his hotel room. But the Derringer with the chocolate-colored wooden grip is his personal favorite. It is not lost on him that the pistol's primary traits, elegance, stealth, and the potential to produce mayhem, match those of its owner. Booth is almost out of ammunition. He loads his gun for one last shot, still plotting his next course of action. He is absolutely certain that he can kidnap Abraham Lincoln. But as Booth himself would utter while performing Hamlet, there's the rub. If the war is over, then kidnapping Lincoln is pointless. Yet Lincoln is still the enemy. He always will be. So if Booth is no longer a kidnapper, then how will he wage war? This is the question that has bothered him all night. Booth fires his last shot, slides the Derringer into his pocket, and storms out of the door, only to once again find the streets full of inebriated revelers. Outraged, he steps into a tavern and knocks back a drink. John Wilkes Booth thinks hard about what comes next. Our cause being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done, he tells himself. Until now, Booth has taken orders from the Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, currently in hiding. It was Davis who nearly a year ago sent two agents to Montreal with a fund of $1 million in gold, and that money funded various plots against Abraham Lincoln. But Davis is done, fleeing to North Carolina in a train filled with looted Confederate gold, most likely never to return. Booth alone must decide for himself what is wrong and what is right. From this moment forward, Booth will live and breathe and scheme in accordance with his brand new identity and his new mission. The time has come for Black Flag Warfare. Chapter 18, Monday, April 10th, 1865, Washington, D.C., evening. Booth's Washington residence is the National Hotel on the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and 6th. Just around the corner is James Pumphrey's stable, where he often rents a horse. The actor feels perfectly at home at Pumphrey's, for the owner is also known to be a Confederate sympathizer. Now, well past 8, and with no streetlights beyond the city limits, the night is far too dark for a ride in the country. But a half-drunk Booth needs to get on a horse now, right now, and gallop through Washington, D.C., reassuring himself that he is a way out of the city after putting a bullet in Abraham Lincoln. I am the man who will end Abraham Lincoln's life. That thought motivates Booth as he walks. He returns to the idea over and over again. He is thrilled by the notion, not bothered in the least by his ability to make the mental jump from the passive violence of kidnapping to cold-blooded murder. I will kill the President of the United States. Booth ruminates without remorse. Of course, killing a man is immoral. Even Booth knows that. This is wartime. Killing the enemy is no more illegal than capturing him. The actor thinks of Lincoln's second inaugural and how he stood so close to the President on that day. I could have shot him then, if I had wished. Booth regrets the lost opportunity and then sets it aside. There will be another chance, and this time he will stand even closer, so close he can't miss, so close he will see the life drain from Lincoln's eyes. It occurs to him that no American president has ever been assassinated. I will be the first man ever to kill a president. He is now even more dazzled by his own violent plan. The United States is just 3 months shy of being 89 years old. There are 36 states in the Union thanks to Nevada's recent admission. Lincoln is the 16th president. Two have passed away from illness while in office. None of them, as Booth well knows, has died by someone else's hand. If successful in his assassination attempt, the actor will achieve the lasting recognition he has always craved. For a nation founded by rebellion and torn open by a civil war, the citizens of the United States have been remarkably nonviolent when confronted with politicians they despise. Only one American president was the target of an assassin, and that was Andrew Jackson, the man whose politics sowed the seeds of Confederate rebellion 30 years earlier. Jackson was leaving a funeral in the Capitol building on January 30, 1835, when a British expatriate fired at him twice. Unfortunately for the mentally unbalanced Richard Lawrence, who believed himself to be the King of England, both his pistols misfired. The bullets never left the chamber. Congressman Davy Crockett wrestled Lawrence to the ground and disarmed him, even as Jackson beat the would-be assassin with his cane. Jackson was also the first and only American president to suffer bodily harm at the hands of a citizen when a sailor discharged from the Navy for embezzlement punched Jackson at a public ceremony in 1833. Robert Randolph fled the scene. Jackson, ever the warrior, refused to press charges. These are the only acts of presidential insurrection in the nation's entire history. The American people are unique in that their considerable political passion is expressed at the ballot box, not through violence directed at their leaders, whom they can vote out of office. If judged only by this yardstick, the democratic experiment undertaken by Americans 49 years ago seems to be working. Maybe this is why Lincoln rides his horse alone through Washington or stands fearlessly on the top deck of a ship in a combat zone. The president tries to convince himself that assassination is not part of the American character, saying, I can't believe that anyone has shot or will deliberately shoot at me with the purpose of killing me. A wider look at human history suggests otherwise. Tribal societies murdered their leaders long before the Egyptian pharaoh, Tutankhamun, was slain by his advisors in 1324 BC. Stabbing and beating were the earliest methods of assassination. The Moabite king, Eglon, was disemboweled in his chambers, his girth so vast that the killer lost the knife in the folds of his fat. Over time, well-known historical figures such as Philip II of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great, and perhaps even Alexander himself, were assassinated. And politically motivated killing was not limited to Europe or the Middle East. Records show that assassination had long been practiced in India, Africa, and China. And then, of course, there was Julius Caesar, the victim of the most famous assassination in history. The Roman ruler was stabbed 23 times by members of the Roman Senate. Of the two stab wounds to his chest, one was the blow that killed him. The killing took place during a lunar cycle known as the Ides, fulfilling a prophecy by a local soothsayer. The truth is that Abraham Lincoln, despite what he says, secretly believes he will die in office. He is by far the most despised and reviled president in American history. His closest friend and security advisor, the barrel-chested Ward Hill Lehman, preaches regularly to Lincoln about the need for improved security measures. More tangibly, there is a packet nestled in a small cubby of Lincoln's upright desk. It is marked, quite simply, assassination. Inside are more than 80 death threats. Every morning, sitting in his office to conduct affairs of state, Lincoln's eyes cannot help but see those letters. "God damn your goddamned old hellfire, goddamn soul to hell," reads one letter. "God damn you and your goddamn family's goddamned hellfire, goddamn soul to hell." The first one or two made me a little uncomfortable, Lincoln has admitted to an artist who came to paint his portrait, but they have ceased to give me any apprehension. "I know I am in danger, but I am not going to worry over little things like these." Rather than dwell on death, Lincoln prefers to live life on his own terms. "If I am killed, I can die but once," he is fond of saying, "but to live in constant dread is to die over and over again." While the war still raged, he told writer Harriet Beecher Stowe, "Whichever way the war ends, I have the impression that I will not last long after it is over." A small number of assassins are delusional or impulsive killers, but on the whole, the successful assassin stalks his target, planning every detail of the crime. This means knowing the victim's habits, schedule, nuances, and security detail. Only then can the two most complex and dangerous tasks be successfully executed. The first involves a shooting. And in 1865, it must be a shooting because there is little likelihood of getting close enough to stab a major political figure. The assassin must figure out the when and where, a large crowd is ideal, determine how to get in and out of the building or ceremony, and choose the perfect weapon. Second is the escape. A successful assassin is a murderer. A perfect assassination, however, means getting away from the scene of the murder without being caught. This is even more of a long shot than the crime itself. Plenty of men in those large crowds will want to play the hero. They will tackle and subdue the assailant without fear for their own lives. And even if an assassin eludes those crowds, he must escape the city in which it takes place, and then the country, until arriving at some foreign location of true refuge. As Booth strolls to Pumphreys, he carries a map in his coat pocket showing the location of General Joe Johnston and his Confederate holdouts who are hiding in North Carolina. Booth knows the map by heart. He can pinpoint the precise route Johnston must take to evade the federal troops and reignite the war. To Booth, the map is much more than a detailed depiction of contours and boundaries. It is also a glimmer of hope, reminding him that the noble cause is alive and well, and why he must do what he must do. His mind wanders to his buggy, of all things. Booth bought it to transport Lincoln after the kidnapping. Now it serves no purpose. Booth makes a mental note to put the buggy up for sale, but in an instant, his thoughts revert back to President Lincoln, who now has only 5 days to live. Chapter 19, Monday, April 10th, 1865, Washington, D.C., evening. John Wilkes Booth turns onto C Street and then out of the cold, wet night into James Pumphrey's stable. His clothes are damp. He smells of drink and tobacco. A quick glance around the stalls shows that most of the horses are already rented for the evening. Pumphrey may be a Confederate sympathizer and a full-fledged member of the secessionist movement, but he has no qualms about making an honest buck off this night of Union celebration. Pumphrey is an acquaintance of 20-year-old John Surratt, The courier instrumental in ensuring that Booth's operation is fully funded by the Confederacy. Surratt travels frequently between Canada, the South, New York City, and Washington, brokering deals for everything from guns to medicine. Like Booth, the young man is furious that the Confederacy has lost. John Surratt is often hard to locate, but when Booth needs details about his whereabouts or simply wants to get a message to him, the task is as simple as walking to 6th and 8th Streets, where his mother keeps a boarding house. Mary Surratt is an attractive widow in her early 40s whose husband died from drink, forcing her to move to Washington from the Maryland countryside to make a living. Like her son, Mary is an active Confederate sympathizer who has been involved with spying and smuggling weapons. She also runs a pro-Confederate tavern in the Maryland town of Surrattsville, where she and her late husband once owned a tobacco farm. The Maryland countryside is untouched by war and not occupied by Union troops. Washington, D.C., with its federal employees and Union loyalties, is a city whose citizens are all too prone to report any conversation that suggests pro-Confederate leanings, making it a dangerous place for people like Mary Surratt and John Wilkes Booth. Her boarding house and Pumphrey Stable are two of the few places they can speak their minds. For Booth, a man who deeply enjoys doing just that, such locations are safe havens. It would seem natural that Booth tell others about his new plan. They might have insights into the best possible means of escape. Roads under construction or in need of repair, overcrowded streets, bridges still under wartime guard, for the only way out of Washington is on a boat or over a bridge. The first exit is via the Georgetown Aqueduct, a mile and a half northwest of the White House. The second is Long Bridge, three blocks south of the White House. The third is Benning's Bridge, on the east side of town. And the last one is the Navy Yard Bridge on 11th Street. But Booth has already made up his mind. It will be the Navy Yard Bridge. The other three lead into Virginia, with its plethora of roadblocks and Union soldiers. But the Navy Yard Bridge will take him into the quiet backcountry of Maryland, home to smugglers and back roads. Friends like Mary Surratt and Dr. Samuel Mudd can offer their homes as way stations for a man on the run, storing weapons for him and providing a place to sleep and eat before getting back on the road. The only drawback is that sentries man the bridge, and no traffic is allowed in or out of Washington after 10 p.m. Booth wants to see those sentries for himself, tonight, which is why he's come for a horse. He doesn't tell Pumphrey, just to be on the safe side. In the end, it doesn't matter. Booth's favorite horse has already been rented. Not the least bit discouraged, Booth walks up to Ford's Theater on 10th Street. This converted Baptist church is Booth's touchstone. After it was burned to the ground in 1863, owner John Ford rebuilt it as a magnificent thespian temple, replacing the pews with seats and transforming the deacon stalls into private boxes. Upon completion, Ford's became the most state-of-the-art theater in Washington. Booth performed one night at Ford's in mid-March, but his theater appearances are few and far between these days. If asked, he explains that he has taken a hiatus to dabble in the oil business. He still, however, has his mail sent to Ford's, and his buggy is parked in a space behind the theater that was specifically created for him by a carpenter and scene shifter named Ned Spangler. Booth uses Spangler often for such favors and odd jobs. 39 and described by friends as a very good, efficient drudge, the hard-drinking Spangler often sleeps in either the theater or a nearby stable. Despite the late hour, Booth knows he will find him at Ford's. Inside the theater, rehearsals are underway for a one-night-only performance of the farce Our American Cousin. Like most actors, Booth knows it well. Booth finds Spangler backstage befuddled as usual. He asks the stagehand to clean up his carriage and find a buyer. Spangler is devastated. A great many hours of work have gone into modifying the theater's storage space so that the carriage will fit. It's a waste for Booth to sell the carriage, and Spangler tells him so. I have no further use for it, Booth replies, and anyway, I'll soon be leaving town. Booth will not say where he's going, leaving Spangler even more befuddled. The word assassin comes from Hashashin, the name of a group of hitmen who worked for Persian kings between the 8th and 14th centuries. One of their jobs was to execute the Knights Templar, a legendary band of Christian warriors known for their cunning and ferocity in battle. Legend says that the reward for a successful execution was being able to visit a lush royal garden filled with milk, honey, hashish, and concubines. None of those things await John Wilkes Booth. He is everything an effective assassin should be. Methodical, passionate, determined, and an excellent strategist and planner. He is prone to depression, as many assassins are. But his ability to turn angst into rage makes him even more dangerous. He expects no reward for killing Lincoln, though infamy would be nice. Chapter 20, Tuesday, April 11th, 1865, Washington, evening. Lee's surrender at Appomattox is just 2 days old, but events are moving so quickly that it might as well be 2 months. The citizens of Washington have spent today sleeping off their celebratory hangover. Now, as evening falls, they will once again spill out into the streets and sip a drink or two. Just like that, the party starts all over. As it grows and becomes more rowdy, every guzzle and utterance has a hum and anticipation. Abraham Lincoln is speaking tonight. Love him or hate him, the President of the United States is making a personal appearance at the White House, and everyone wants to see it. And then, once again, the crowd is on the march. The spring air is thick with a warm mist as the sea of humanity parades down Pennsylvania Avenue. Thousands upon thousands are on their way to hear Lincoln speak, trampling the White House lawn and standing up to their ankles in the mud of once-manicured daffodil beds, pushing and straining against one another, climbing into trees and even pressing up against the great building itself. All are desperate to be as close to Abraham Lincoln as possible. But hungover, dehydrated, and sullen, this is not the lighthearted crowd of the night before. It is something akin to a lynch mob, thirsty for Lincoln's words and yet ready to pass judgment on them. And this is what the mob wants to hear. The South must be punished. These men and women of the North, who have endured the loss of their sons, brothers, and husbands, want vengeance. They want the Confederate leaders and generals hanged. They want the South to pay war reparations. And they want Lincoln's speech to be full of the same self-righteous indignation they feel so powerfully in their hearts. John Wilkes Booth leans against a tall tree, using it as a buffer against the crowd. He is close enough that Lincoln will be a mere pistol shot away. With him are two co-conspirators. David Herold is a former pharmacy clerk who was born and raised in Washington. Like Booth, he possesses matinee idol good looks, but he is more educated and rugged. Harold's degree comes from Georgetown, and he is fond of spending his leisure time with a rifle in his hand hunting animals. It was John Surratt who introduced the two 4 months earlier. Since then, Harold has been an impassioned and committed member of Booth's team. The second co-conspirator is Lewis Powell, who also goes by the name Lewis Payne, a 20-year-old who served as a Confederate soldier and spy before joining Booth's cause. Like Harold, he has fallen under Booth's spell. The actor has not told either man that the plan has changed from kidnapping to assassination. That can wait. He brought them along to hear the speech, hoping that some phrase or anticipated course of action will fill them with rage. Then and only then will Booth let them in on his new plan. Soon, Lincoln stands before an open second-story window, a scroll of paper in one hand. The president is wearing the same black garb he usually wears, but no hat. He is somber. His speech is now written, and he is ready to give it. Unseen by the crowd, Mary Lincoln shows her husband her support by standing next to him. She has invited Clara Harris, her dear friend and daughter of a New York senator, to stand with her and witness this historical moment. Outside, the mere sight of Lincoln elicits a prolonged ovation. The applause rolls on and on.